Hello and welcome to the Unmissables podcast. I am Boyd Hilton. At Heat Magazine, I work with a lady called Kay Ribeiro, and she's sitting next to me right now.
Hi.
And we don't work with a lovely man called John, who is our podcast guru, teacher, producer, editor.
Friend. You always forget friend.
But he does work in the building downstairs. Hi, John.
Yeah, I work in the... I was trying to think of a funny place I could work in
the
an
basement.
Office.
That's the where
basement.
We keep him.
You are in the basement.
Mostly editing this podcast.
Yeah.
And he's usually Silent John. That's his name. We call him Silent John.
Well,
but he made a guest appearance last week because Steph
gone
was
to
off.
My head.
Yeah. And now he's demanded space. He's demanded a seat at the table and he's got it.
That's not quite strictly true. We begged him to rejoin us because Steph's still absent for the first part, at least, of this podcast. But she will be joining us later in a magical transformation of podcast voices.
It's just how she rolls.
Yeah. So The Unmissables is our weekly trawl through the world of popular culture slash mostly TV with a bit of film. There's quite a lot of film this week, actually, in terms of me droning on about Thor Ragnarok. And another film, mystery film, I'm going to talk about as well, Kay. I haven't told you about that. Yeah.
No, you haven't.
I've got another film in my arsenal that I wish to discuss.
Sounds uncomfortable.
Yes. And then in the main body of the podcast, where we do proper reviews and stuff, we're going to be looking at Blue Planet 2.
Yes! Woohoo!
7 years, maybe longer after the original Blue Planet, here is the very welcome sequel with Sir David Attenborough holding forth about things in oceans.
Should be a lord.
David Attenborough, yeah.
Yeah. Not
probably
you.
Will
I mean,
be,
you
I'm
should
sure.
Be
any
a
minute
lord
now.
Too.
Any minute will be a lord. Living the Dream is a new comedy drama about a family moving from Britain to Florida.
Mm-hmm.
And that was going to be on Sky One and Now TV from next Thursday. We're going to review that as well, aren't we, Kay?
Yes, we are.
And I am saying possibly the most highly anticipated bit of content of the year, Stranger Things 2.
Never seen it.
Well, that's why we're giving you a chance to shift out of the scene
yeah.
and let Steph come in, who has seen it. Later on, we'll be talking about Stranger
I'm
Things 2.
Be banished from the room.
Yeah, I just don't think a Stranger Things virgin should be allowed to even witness
we're
the
so
discussion.
Out of order.
Know,
we should explain, actually, it's that no one could see it really in time for our deadline. So Steph's going to watch it. And then I'm on holiday, so she is going to take that battle.
Yes, me and Steph are going to watch it in full. It's available now. It's on my screen now, ready. As soon as I finish this podcast, I'm going to run to my desk, John, and crank up the Netflix thing that I've got, the special preview service, and I'm going to watch all 9 episodes of bloody Stranger Things 2. What do you think of that?
Amazing. But to the listener, not a second will have passed.
No, I know.
The time when you watch all 9 episodes.
It's a weird time. You know, it's a timey-wimey thing. That's what Stephen Moffat used to call the Doctor Who when Doctor Who did a strange time jump.
That's what it is.
Yeah, we're playing around with time. Anyway, enough of this nonsense. What have we been all enjoying, watching, reading, listening to this week? Kay Ribeiro, where would you like to start?
I would first of all like to start with the final episode of Liar. Now, did either of you watch it?
Yes, I did.
John?
I'm afraid not.
Okay,
have you watched any of Liar, John?
No, I haven't. And you guys gave an excellent review. And it's on my meaning to watch list.
Are you one of those people who doesn't watch ITV? Like a lot of,
No, because you watch Time Wasters. Isn't that ITV?
That's ITV2.
ITV2.
Yeah, ITV's the mainstream channel.
No, he's a big Coronation
Street
fan.
I am worried. Yeah.
Yeah.
I am worried I am a bit of an ITV snob.
Yeah,
and
there
that's
are
totally my fault.
There are a lot of them about.
I roll.
But we watch ITVK.
I
yeah,
ITV.
Liar. It was the Williams Brothers other show.
There wasn't Relic
on BBC One. Yeah, and the finale, what did you think?
I'm semi-content with the ending. I liked it.
That's going to go on the poster. Semi-content.
No, because it wasn't like Dr. Foster, which I was a bit disappointed about, which we disagree on, I know.
Yeah.
But for me, Dr. Foster was so kind of like high octane, a bit like some of the things she did was so kind of out there and outlandish. I expected that kind of finale, and it wasn't. It was quite muted in comparison to the bulk of it. So that's why I think I was disappointed with Dr. Foster's ending. However, this one I thought was completely in keeping with the tone of the show. And I really, there were some things that Laura did were slightly unrealistic, but on the whole, I thought it was believable. And I was really happy at the reappearance of Ian. So he's played
Ian,
Kieran
yes.
Bew, who she met in the hotel and she struck up a friendship.
No, indeed.
You know, she was a bit reticent at first, but yeah.
A flirtation.
Yeah, and so I'm happy about his reappearance.
Yeah.
I'm not giving away anything,
no.
obviously.
We're not giving away the ending.
We're no, we're not.
Right, okay.
But
fine.
What I would say is
it is still on ITV Player, obviously.
Yeah, and I would never... I hate people who spoil stuff.
Yeah.
But my main gripe about it is that, obviously, as we know, Andrew Erlam is a total nasty bastard. But, so I kind of like... I wanted to see his moment of reckoning and, you know, I don't feel I got that kind of satisfaction. And I also feel like the finale was teeing up for another series, which I hate. More and more writers are doing that, and I don't like it. So, you know, when I was watching that Spanish foreign drama?
Spanish.
I know who you are, Seiki.
Oh, yeah.
And they did the same thing.
You're really testing my knowledge, powers of remembrance.
I like
there.
To think you listen to what the hell I'm saying.
Well, testing knowledge of remembrance of a Spanish drama in the BBC Floor, BBC Floor, BBC Four Saturday Night.
Well,
slot.
It was BBC Floored because the ending wasn't.
So this is hard. So you're trying to describe your main issue with the ending of this programme that we're trying not to spoil.
Yeah.
And I'm saying, we know because Series 2 has been announced, obviously, because that was announced straight afterwards.
Yes.
And we can't really explain how what they're going to do in Series 2 because that's a spoiler in itself. Yeah, it's hard. I agree. I thought the ending was good.
So it was good, but it was just like, I wanted to see.
You wanted to see the thing that you can't see because Series 2 is going to deal with that.
Yes. I wanted to see the smug face wiped off his face.
Right.
Look.
Well, you've given away the smug face isn't wiped off his face.
Would you rather a TV show? No. Would you rather that the TV show didn't set up for a second series and then just did it anyway?
I would.
So, because some people would have put that against Dr. Foster, as the whole thing was it didn't feel like it. Mm. There was any idea that you'd have a second series.
I don't mind that there's going to be another series. I think we've just been building for a moment that didn't quite come for me.
Well, all I would say is that, you know, every drama series known to humanity, effectively, you know, when it ends, I mean, you can tie up all the loose ends, and obviously the world still carries on, and unless everyone dies, which is what I kept saying about Dr. Foster, well, I was trying not to spoil it. Not everyone dies, so it could carry on for a third series right now, even though it probably won't. Whereas with this, again, not everyone dies, so there is going to be a second series, but actually, you know, what happens in the end is still a pretty firm ending. Is again, I'm trying not to spoil things. So, yeah, I thought that was quite clever, actually. That here's what I'm trying to say. That could have been an ending without a second series, I think.
Yeah, no, of course. Yeah. I think, look, you know, I'm
That's
a vigilante.
Quite clever.
You know, I'm a vigilante. Oh, boy, it's getting so...
Just smash my phone.
I'm a vigilante. I like justice.
You are a vigilante. Yeah. Like many of the people in Liar. Yeah,
exactly.
No,
so,
no spoilers.
Yeah.
And what else?
Also, The Last Post. So we have reviewed that before.
Yeah.
Now, John, that was the one that was set in the army barracks, and it was like focused on the kind of the wives of the officers as much as what was going on the battlefield, which I quite liked. And it's so good. So I've watched 3 episodes now. And I'd urge anyone who hasn't seen it, it's on Sunday nights, BBC One, to watch it. Because do you know who I particularly like? Jessica Raine. I think she's completely mesmerizing as this. She plays Alison Lathwaite, who is kind of like, on the face of it, it's just this drunken, you know, wife who can't control herself, quite debauched. But actually, she's just really disappointed in life and her lot. And it's actually quite sad to see. And she's got this, she struck up this friendship with Jessica Buckley's character. And it's just really moving to watch. And episode 3 was action-packed. There was kidnapping.
Ooh.
It was all going on. It was Christmas Day. Loads of stuff was happening. Yeah, it wasn't all like fun and jollity that you'd usually have on a
fun and jollity?
Yeah.
No.
Jollity.
No fun and jollity.
No jollity.
Some Christmas jollity.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, I'm excited, yeah.
And other than that, just been catching up on Series 2 of Curb, you'll be happy to know.
Yeah, so Kay, we have a tradition, dear listener, that Kay suddenly decides to watch something that everyone else has been watching for about a decade. So, do you remember The West Wing, John? Well, possibly the greatest drama series on TV, I mean, some would say.
Correct, yeah.
It's only up there. And anyway, after it finished, you know, 7 however many seasons there were of it, hundreds of episodes, Kay suddenly walked into the kitchen one day at Heat and said, I'm going to start watching The West Wing. And it became a running joke that she watches everything about 10 years too late. And now, Curb Enthusiasm, we're on, season 9, I think, now, which some of us are watching live, very excitedly, every Monday on Sky Atlantic / Now TV. You're on Series 2.
Yeah, and listen, I think there's some people listening. The people on the ground, the POGs, are our listeners, who probably are in the same boat. So I don't think we should be pouring scorn on anyone.
I'm not. No scorn is being poured. I'm just explaining the situation.
Yeah, that is the situation. I'm a late starter with some shows. But now that I'm in it, I obviously love it. And I recently watched The Shrimps Incident, which, for anyone who can cast their mind back who has seen it, is when basically Larry pitches this idea to an HBO executive who he then feels has been stealing shrimp out of his Chinese takeaway. And it is genius.
Are you a Curb fan, John?
I'm not.
Oh,
and I was about
yes!
to say, but this is ignorance, not anti.
You're right.
there's a thing that happens with these amazing TV shows that once they get to a certain series, even if someone tells you it's brilliant, you think...
You feel like you can't jump in.
Oh,
it's
that's
too
a
late.
Lot to catch. That's yeah. a real commitment to catch up yeah. on that show. So yeah. I've had that with most of the great TV shows. So
see?
Your Breaking Bad's, your...
John's in
So you've never watched
boat.
Breaking Bad?
No, your Game of Thrones.
Yeah, me too. Oh, yeah. I haven't watched that.
You're a holdout. You're holding out.
Yeah, maybe kind one of day I'll just have a weekend where
Wire?
I don't do anything. Yep, The Wire.
You've watched The Wire?
Nope.
No, you haven't watched The Wire.
The Wire's another one.
The Sopranos.
It's in the list.
The West Wing.
I don't think I've ever seen television.
John, just to be fair, John listens to a lot of podcasts.
That's true. You are That's Mr. Podcast.
I don't have a TV. No, I do.
Oh, you're he's not got, one of those. I
no,
don't
no,
know.
No, he's got a cardboard TV. Box with a picture on the
yeah,
front of
the
TV.
Yeah, okay, fine.
I draw podcasts.
Do you know what?
Listening.
I'm jealous of both of you because I feel like you've got, I mean, you've got 9 seasons of Curb to go. They're all on Sky Atlantic Now TV box sets, by the way. Buy them on physical box
and Sky, they just let it roll on. Yeah. That's the problem.
So you've got that unbelievable pleasure. I have to wait every week on Monday for the effing new episode of
Curb. So who's laughing now?
Can I just say, and also, let me just say, as a fan of Larry David and Curb Your Enthusiasm, he co-created Seinfeld, and Seinfeld, the greatest sitcom of all time, is there for you 9 seasons of that for you to watch, effectively.
Yeah, I haven't watched that either.
You've got, no, what I'm saying is, you've got all that to watch as well. The greatest, you've got that to discover. So, and that's all on Amazon Prime,
I think. Don't be jealous, people.
I'm jealous.
Yeah. What have you been watching? I mean, presumably you've watched, like, everything that's old, new, and probably in the future.
Have I watched everything that's old, new, and probably in the future? I've watched every future thing, yeah. No, I haven't watched everything, Kay, but, you know, I've watched a lot, yeah. I mean, it's my job. Mm. You know, I've literally been a TV reviewer most of my adult life, so to be fair, it is my main task is to sit there watching stuff on TV. So I make no bones about that. Yes, I've watched loads of shit. But this week, I'm talking mainly about films, actually. I'm going to quickly mention that I watched the whole of Mindhunter. So we reviewed that. Was that last week or the week before?
Week before.
The David Fincher directed 4 of them. It's the thing about based on the true story of the 2 investigators who are psychologically profiling serial killers. They meet real serial killers, played by actors, but they're based on real serial killers in history, and they interview them. And it is an incredible achievement. Like I've watched all 10 episodes, and I'm so obsessed with it. And what the main thing you realise, you kind of only read, it's one of those series where you don't really realise what it's about until you finished it, and kind of what it's about is Jonathan Groff, who brilliantly cast as this normal, likable, blonde-haired, blue-eyed, all-American guy, every man, and starts off being quite naive and kind of stilted in a way. Mm. By the end of it, he's become a kind of a monster.
No!
Yeah. And what? It's, yeah. Spoiler
oh my God,
alert.
So I just watched, spoiler. Yeah, that's I mean, a there's massive
no,
spoiler.
No, it's the theme of the thing, you know, it's the whole...
In what way? What, does he get all killy?
No, sorry, he's not literally killing people yet. Oh. No, it's more, yeah, or
he's
even...
A, he's
I don't
a, demi,
think,
he's
he won't.
A semi-monster.
A monster more in terms of his ego and his fine. Personality. And his drive to speak to these psychopaths. And he becomes a bit psychopathic. Like he loses empathy with people around him, his girlfriend, his colleagues, and he becomes fixated on this serial killing thing going on. It's really interesting. There's a brilliant subplot about a man, a teacher, a headmaster in a school that he stumbles upon who tickles children's feet. And there's an incredibly interesting. It's a, yeah, I know.
Makes
it's
you feel uncomfortable.
Queasy. Well, yeah, it's all about what do you do with that information? Does that mean you know it's his?
Does he ask them before he does it?
Yeah, it's a very interesting
thing. So he gets permission and then he tickles the kids.
Yeah, feet. It's a brilliant.
He's literally a kiddie fiddler.
Right, indeed. But you know, but does that mean that he goes further and does you know unspeakable things, or does he just stay at that? And there's a brilliant kind of moral dilemma going on. With Jonathan Groff's character about that case. It's so interesting. It's so cleverly done. Anyway, I only meant to mention that in about 10 seconds, and I've gone on about that for about fucking 2 minutes. Apologies. So I've gone on about Mindhunter way too long already because I've got some films to mention.
Go on, shoot.
The big one is Thor Ragnarok. Let me quickly say before that, Call Me By Your Name, which is out next Friday, is this fantastic, one of the best films of the year. It is a gay romance between a guy in his kind of mid-20s, played by Armie Hammer, who was in The Social Network. Do you remember The Social Network? He played the twins.
Yeah, yeah.
The Winklevi, I think they were called, weren't they? Yeah, he was brilliant. And he is kind of visits this professor in Italy in 1983, played by Michael Stuhlbarg, and his son, his young son, I think he's 18, 17, 18, something like that, but he's a teenager. And they fall in love, and that's the whole thing. It's kind of like, is it or isn't it forbidden love? But it's just a brilliantly judged fantastically made, brilliantly acted film. And Timothy Chalamet, who is who's French, who plays the teenager, is going to be a huge star. And Armie Hammer has never been better. And there's this brilliant scene towards the end, quite close to the end, where the father talks to the son about stuff, and it's one of the great scenes of the year.
Kay? Really?
Yeah, it's so brilliant.
Oh, I want to see that. Yeah. How many stars are we giving it?
Call Me By Your Name. We're giving it 5 stars, Kay. And it opens the cinemas on Friday. And as does the big film of the week, is Thor Ragnarok.
Can you say the second word slowly?
Or Ragnarok. Ragnarok.
What does that mean?
It's a Norse thing. It's a Norse event.
Thing. Okay.
It's the apocalypse.
It's
isn't
the apocalypse,
it?
Kind of. Yeah.
Look it's at like, John up with his Norse knowledge.
Yeah, I mean, and we're talking ancient Nordics as well, not current. You know, we're talking about some kind of weird
Yoldy.
Viking Nordic ancient apocalyptic mythology. Ragnarok,
okay.
Yeah. But here's the thing, it does exist. It's not just a word that's been invented by Marvel for their third Thor film, as you might think. So it's all about... I know you're a huge fan of the superheroes, aren't you, Kay?
Yeah, I am.
Yeah. You don't care
No,
about
I like them. Spider-Man, as I say every bloody time you mention this.
Yeah. Well, Thor and Hulk weren't in Captain America Civil War much, which was the previous big kind of Avengers-y gathering of superheroes film. But this is all about Thor and Hulk. He's got to battle his elder sister, Hela, played by Kate Blanchett, brilliantly, whose transformation, in superhero films, it's like, superhero dons his costume with the thing and the cape. And Batman has the cape and thing and helmet. And she flicks her hair back and turns it into this amazing kind of like horns thing going on, black horns.
Yes, a sassy flip of the hair.
Sassy hair flick.
We've all been there.
So she's brilliant, Kate Blanchett. She's the main villain. Then she's kind of, there's like an associate kind of, at least amoral figure played by Jeff Goldblum. Basically Jeff Goldblum playing himself, being Jeff Goldblum in a film. What more could you want?
Dude.
Looking a bit like something out of Flash Gordon. Remember the Flash Gordon film in the 80s? It looks exactly like something out of that. And what happens is that Thor ends up on this planet, and to escape and to try and go back to his home planet to save everyone from Kate Blanchett, he has to fight the Hulk, who's been kidnapped and is like imprisoned there. And the Hulk is taking part in all these battles, like these kind of in arenas, fighting, basically killing anyone who dare to battle him. And they've got to fight each other in order to escape. It's a bit convoluted.
Wait a minute.
You're looking at me like
gladiators.
What is this? Shit.
Oh
yeah, it's
my
like
God,
gladiators.
What, like ITV's
not
Gladiators?
Gladiators.
No. It's like Marvel's Gladiators, featuring
are they both
the Hulk
goodies?
And Thor. They're both goodies, yeah. But the
and
Hulk,
they're fighting each other.
Well, the Hulk is obviously the big, green, gigantic...
I love Hulk.
...monster superhero that Bruce Banner transforms into.
Yeah.
But what's happened is that he's ended up, slight spoiler alert, but not really, he's ended up being the Hulk for about 2 years since we last saw him and can't not
he
be
just
the
can't
Hulk
shake it
he's
off.
Just constantly now in the state of anger and being the Hulk. Basically, he turns into Hulk when he gets angry.
He's been
and
not
Bruce
in
Banner,
London.
Lovely Bruce Banner, normal Bruce Banner, played by Mark Ruffalo, is a lovely guy. I mean, he's great. But when he turns into Hulk, obviously, he's this hulking beast who can take on all comers. Yeah. That's the basic plot, but it doesn't really matter. The thing about it is like a huge, big Marvel superhero blockbuster movie, costing hundreds of billions of dollars, but it's directed by this tight guy called Taika Waititi, who is this maverick New Zealand... Don't laugh at his name, Kay. Unbelievable.
Love his name.
Taika Waititi, deal with it. Who is this New Zealand director who made this film, Hunt for the Wilder People. John's nodding. Hunt for the Wilder People.
Film.
Brilliant film. Came out, what, 1 or 2 years ago? Sam Neill.
I'm not sure.
Sam Neill going around in the wilds of New Zealand with this young boy who he adopted. And it's a brilliant kind of mismatched, isn't it, buddy film.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he also did What We Do in the Shadows,
what we do
which
in the
is
shadows.
A vampire mockumentary with Jermaine from Flight of the Conchords.
Yeah. He's got a very quirky sense of humour. He makes comedies, doesn't he? Interesting, very wry kind of... out of left field
comedies. If
you're
being cynical, you'd say Sundance comedies.
Oh, yeah, kind of indie, quirky indie, yeah. And he's brought that sensibility, Kay, to this huge, massive blockbuster.
It's unusual then, right?
It's incredibly unusual. So I think it's a little bit like Guardians of the Galaxy, obviously, is the kind of fairly comedic end, which we did all review together, didn't we, I believe?
Unless
I completely lost my mind,
which
you enjoyed. So that was funny. That was pretty funny, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
This is like even more out there and
so, like,
being funny.
Is it a bit Deadpool-y?
Yes, less rude. Deadpool was all about being rude and irreverent and almost like reveling in the swearing. This is still a 12A. This is still a family film. So, like, kids, 12-year-old kids can still love it and watch it. It's just that it's flat out funny. It's basically, for me, it's like a comedy with action sequences and superheroes. At one point, I almost think, is this being too comedic? Like, do I care at all about the characters anymore?
Yeah.
And I just about did. Everyone who went to the huge big screening at the Edinburgh Square seemed to love it. And I just had the odd moment where I thought, oh my, this is almost too relentlessly funny. And it's still
there
asking
could be
us,
no such thing.
Yeah,
book.
But I, and then at the end, I thought, no, we just got to go along with it. And it is incredibly entertaining.
How many stars?
We've given it 4 stars. It's like it's 4.5/5. It's a 4.5/5 situation.
Okay.
Charles Gann, our official reviewer, gave it 4.
I always go with what Charles says. So
always go with what Charles says.
It's a 4 for me then, probably.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's. And the other thing I wanted to mention quickly is I'm on another podcast as well this week.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
What?
The Evolution of Horror podcast.
You know, I hate when you cheat on us like this.
I'm cheating on you. So the Evolution of Horror podcast that my friend Mike Munzer does, it's a brilliant. It's all about horror films, Kay, so I know you're going to love it because you love your horror films. You love your gore and your violence.
I love me some gore.
Yeah, I'm on that. He has a guest every week, and I'm this week's guest, and I'm talking about my love for Brian De Palma, who makes really, really disgustingly violent, horrible, nasty films.
I'm glad you took it over there to that pod. I don't want to hear it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so just mentioning that as well. So if you want, yeah, pod expert John.
Yeah.
Evolution of Horror.
He'll know.
Mike Munzer.
Do you rate it?
5 stars.
Oh. And you obviously
well,
this
no,
one's
it's 4
6.
Stars, and then yeah, this week 5 stars.
Yeah, good.
And talking of podcasts, we both started listening to your recommendation from last week, haven't
yes.
we?
Yes,
Dirty John.
I was going to say Dirty Dick. No, Dirty John.
That's a different thing.
Yeah, it's really good. I really love it.
It is incredible.
I'm pleased
that was a
you
good
like
recommendation.
It. Yeah. Good.
What about you, John? What do you want? Anything you want to mention in passing in your or even in full?
Yesterday, I went to a screening of a film called 7852.
Oh my God! I'm so
what
excited about this film.
It is a documentary dedicated entirely to the shower sequence from the Hitchcock film Psycho.
I'm just taking a moment because this is the film, one of the films I'm most excited about this year.
I
can't believe they screened it last night and I wasn't invited.
Look, you're not as big a cheese as John. Silent John.
This also ties in with the podcast because the Evolution of Horror is all about slasher films.
Mm.
And this is literally the ultimate slasher scene, the first ever slasher sequence probably in history of film.
Exactly, yeah.
As written in a feature in Heat magazine that's coming out on Tuesday.
Oh my God,
you wrote yourself.
Yeah, I've written a feature about my favourite horror films. How about that? In Heat.
And it all wraps up because one of the talking heads in the documentary is Boyd's best friend, Guillermo del Toro. So...
oh my God. How is this happening? My mind is blown.
I mean, yeah, me and Guillermo, yeah. He once retweeted me, yeah. But I consider him to be my best friend.
That's best friends
yeah.
in our books.
Who else is in it, John?
Oh gosh, Eli Roth... the body double from the shower scene
amazing.
Itself.
Wow.
There's lots of... I've never seen it before. There's amazing footage from... I guess, you know, in those days, the way they promoted films was totally different. So one of the main ways they promoted it was this video of Hitchcock walking people around the set of the movie. So it'd be like,
good.
And here's the painting. It's very important in the plot of the film, and it is because it's where the peephole's hidden when he looks into the
shower. Yeah,
and yeah, it is brilliant watching
that's
these...
amazing, by the man himself.
And he's such a character, Hitchcock. It's amazing. And if you have any interest in that sequence from that film, you'll love it. Otherwise, maybe it's not for you.
Oh, and it took a week, didn't it, to film that scene? Is that right?
It did.
Think about that, a week to film a scene on screen. What, it's a minute maybe?
Yeah,
maybe
it's not
a minute
very
and
long
a half, 90 seconds, something like that.
So the 7852, I can't remember exactly, but I think 78 is the how many camera setups are in the sequence?
78?
Maybe 52 is the seconds.
It's one of,
how long
yeah,
is?
One of them is the number of the cuts, and one of them is the number of setups. Yeah,
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Yeah, it's incredible. Yeah, and then for years there was—I could go on about this all day. Sorry, now that John's brought it up.
He's open for can of worms.
For years there was the rumor was that Hitchcock didn't even direct it, and that it was directed by the guy who does the title sequence of a lot of Hitchcock films, including Psycho. But then I think
what's
in the
truth?
I think the presumably do they address that in the documentary? John?
It's not that.
Oh,
bit
okay.
Isn't
oh, okay. In the end, it was like no, it was nonsense. The guy was a consultant. The title sequence man, whose name I've forgotten. But in the end, it was Hitchcock who totally directed that sequence. Yeah.
What comes across in this film is Hitchcock knew how important this scene was, and he almost treated that sequence as like an entirely separate film from the rest of the film in terms of the storyboarding and
I've never
time.
Seen the film, it won't shock you, and it's made me want to now see both.
Well, you should watch, because I rewatched it recently, actually, Psycho, funnily enough, partly because of the horror podcast that I was talking about that went on because it was part of that whole story of slasher films and it's incredible how it holds up now. I mean, have you watched it recently?
Yes,
film?
I went to a orchestra live
one of them.
Yeah.
Oh, brilliant. Oh. Yeah, because the score is incredible. Bernard Herrmann.
Oh God, actually, I'm feeling a bit nervous just even talking about it. I don't think I can watch it.
It'll be fine. It'll be fine.
With
I
the lights
on
in
own,
the comfort of your own flat, with the lights on,
you'll be fine.
Listen, I know I'm the one who's usually wrapping us up or got this reputation for doing it, but I just have to talk about one more thing before we move on to the meat. Okay.
I'll allow it.
Thank you. Right. So obviously we like to give a shout out to our super pogs, the people on the ground. You are beloved listeners. And I just wanted to talk about Laura Estelle 84, because not only did she give us a glowing review on iTunes, which, by the way, everyone can do. It's not exclusive to her. If anyone wants to do that, you can. She gave us a lovely 5-star review. But she wrote such nice things. She said basically she's on maternity leave at the moment and she loves listening to us. And the one thing, like, obviously she loves looking after her little poglet. She didn't call it that. I'm calling it that. But one thing she's going to miss from being on maternity leave is having the time to catch up with all our suggestions and watch all the things we've been recommending. So that's nice.
That's a delight.
So, Laura, we hail you as Super Pog this week. That's what you are.
We love you.
We love you.
We love you, Laura.
And we've extended this podcast for an extra 5 minutes, which you know is against the grain for me.
I should also mention then quickly, since you've given me carte blanche, to do shout-outs.
Go on, then.
One of our great pogs, Neil Lark, who is Open Season, a.k.a. Neil Lark, on Twitter, who talks to us a lot. Well, certainly talks to me a lot. Maybe he doesn't even talk to you.
No, he doesn't. All right, Neil.
Anyway, his daughter, Catherine, sent me an audio file of her own film review. Yeah.
Oh, my God, that's so sweet.
Yeah, so because she wants to get into the whole thing. So I've got it. She sent it to the main Heat email, everyone, and they forwarded it to me finally. Yeah. Finally we found it. So, yeah, it's very good. And yeah.
Oh, shout out to Neil, then.
Yeah, yeah. I think Neil's hoping that Catherine will take over the podcast from all of us, but that's not going to happen yet.
Not yet. We'll not till that day that they just basically go, okay, listen, you don't watch any scary things, you've got to get out.
Yeah. If you suddenly feel, you've had enough of it, Kay, then we'll draft Catherine in.
All right, Catherine.
But thank you very much. That was brilliant. Let's move on then to the meat. Woohoo! And boy, what meat, what juicy oceanic meat we've got with Blue Planet 2 with Sir David Attenborough.
Kay. Should be Lord.
I mean, I feel you are the queen of natural history programming on TV.
Yes, and also a close friend of Sir David, having met him.
I mean, we both interviewed him. Let's not...
Well, but he confirmed to me that Rudolph flies.
You're talking about Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer?
Yes. Right?
You interviewed him at
Christmas
time.
There's only one Rudolph.
Well, people might be confused.
Okay, fine.
You interviewed him around Christmas time, didn't you? For a Christmas thing, I think.
For the Christmas issue of we were talking about, obviously, loads of animals. And I was like, look, I just want to clear something up. And he told me that. He said, yeah, of course, Rudolph can fly.
I interviewed him at BAFTA in front of people and, you know, bonded with him for a whole evening, effectively. But yeah, it's not a competition for whose best friend David Attenborough is.
Did he know where you worked? Where did you think you worked?
Heat magazine, yeah.
Okay, well, excuse me, for me, he missed, because he's a little bit deaf, like, it's the truth.
He was about 92.
Yeah, it's fine, I'm not dissing him. He is just deaf, though. And so when I was telling him I worked for Heat magazine, he kept saying, Heath magazine, Heath. Say he thinks I work for Heath.
We got excited at the idea of a magazine about Heaths.
Yeah, I think we all are, aren't we? Black Heath, Hampstead Heath, let's get on it.
No, the first thing I said to him was, Sir Lord David Attenborough, I work for Heath magazine, it's not about Heaths, it's about celebrities and TV and film. And he was fine with it.
Okay.
Anyway, tell us about Blue Planet 2K.
Okay, so this is like the follow-up to Blue Planet 1, will come as no surprise. And it's basically, because of the advances in marine science and cutting-edge technology, they made a follow-up, and it's exploring the oceans, the great oceans in the world, and revealing all that lurks beneath the surface. And it is just absolutely incredible. I mean, listen, I'm going to be saying the word incredible a lot. I apologise now, but let's face it, it's the only word to use for Sir David Attenborough and these kind of programmes, because what he reveals and his team, because it is a massive team that works on this, and actually thousands of hours are spent just exploring everything just to make this hour-long documentary. And the animals underneath there, the creatures, it's just amazing. They use slow-mo cameras that make waves and, like, you know, manta ray flying through the water. It makes it look like it's almost CGI because it's so magical looking. It kind of looks like one of the old masters, like a painting, like with Turner painting. It's just beautiful to watch, and also just obviously incredibly educational.
Absolutely, yeah, it is incredible. No, so because Planet Earth 2 came out last year, which was the sequel to Planet Earth, and that was one of the BBC's biggest ratings hits, like for any kind of program for years and years and years. I think it got like 12-13 million viewers on a Sunday. Oh, like, so the thirst for Attenborough based natural history programming, is enormous.
I thought
enormous.
He would have done it like all his shows would be that big.
Well, no, I think he's done quite a few shows. So the one I interviewed him about at BAFTA was a Sky. He did quite a few shows for Sky a couple of years ago, where he, like 3D ones about.
Was it the museum?
Yeah, he did the museum one. He did flying creatures ones. He's done a few programs that series where he's just narrating it clearly, and he's not there, you know, like. even introducing it. Whereas in this, I think, you know, Blue Planet and Life on Earth are kind of like the real iconic Attenborough shows, aren't they? Where you feel he is driving it to some extent, and he is, you know, his narration is completely key, and he's there at the beginning on a boat introducing the whole thing. Mm. So it feels like a much more iconic thing, these series. And so I think this is going to be a ginormous phenomenal
hit. Oh, it's going to be
hit. Yeah.
Any show that shows bottlenose dolphins surfing,
yes,
just for the sheer damn pleasure of it.
Yes.
There's no reason. They're not doing it for, yes, survival, anything like that. They just like to surf in the South African seas. It's amazing.
And the tusk fish,
yeah,
using an anvil to open clams. Basically, it's like a fish in discovering how to use tools. You know, the beginning of, have you seen 2001 A Space Odyssey?
No.
2001 A Space Odyssey, the classic film. Going off a slight tangent, the whole like first 25 minutes, half an hour of that is set in prehistoric times about apes discovering how to use tools. That's the whole beginning of 2000. And then leaps in time forward millennia to a spaceship going around. There's a famous cut, one of the most famous cuts in film history. This is about fish learning to use tool in the middle of Blue Planet. It is unbelievable.
Basically just smashing a clam against a rock.
It is absolutely extraordinary. There's the whole killer whales thing battling with the dolphins. That's it.
I thought that was going to be a dolphin snuff movie. I was like, oh.
Yeah, I mean, there is fish-based, watery, oceanic violence,
yeah,
we have to say.
There is.
You have to be prepared for that.
But listen, I think the most incredible moment was a female...
Yes.
I don't know if I'm going to say this right.
Kabadai Rase, yes, obviously.
Obviously, sorry.
I don't know.
Which is a fish in the sea, and it just changes sex purely to challenge a male and his harem of female fish. So it actually changes sex. So certain enzymes in it stop working and male hormones start circulating in its body, and it grows this horrendous bulbous forehead and it just becomes a man.
Yeah. Like all men with their horrendous bulbous foreheads.
Exactly. Yeah. I didn't want to bring up your bulbous forehead, John, but it's absolutely incredible. And the thing I loved most about it is that they did this thing, which they have done in previous documentaries of his, where they spend the last 10 minutes just showing what goes into the making of it. Yep. And this...
Yeah, so you see at the end of it, you know, that one of the cameramen had... I think was the cameraman filming the surfing dolphins had to go all the way.
Yeah, he was riding 20-foot waves.
Yeah, but also he goes out one day all the way, and it's quite obviously dangerous going out in the middle of the ocean. There's nothing happened. None of them. They're just not there. No dolphins at all. They're all just sleeping or whatever.
Yeah.
And then he has to go out on the next day, and it's the sea is so violent... And the waves are so big that he nearly gets thrown off his thing that he's travelling on with the camera.
It's terrifying.
Yeah, terrifying. And then finally, they get everything they did. The waves are just high enough for the dolphins to surf, and he gets to film it. And it is incredible. Magical, isn't it, Kay?
It's absolutely magical. And I think we owe a debt of gratitude to Sir Attenborough and also all of his amazing team.
David.
Sir David Attenborough. Because otherwise, I mean, like, how would we... I don't know about you, but, you know, I never plan to... I mean, I can't really swim, so that's why I wouldn't be exploring the ocean.
You cannot swim?
No.
Okay.
Steph's tried to teach me many times and failed. But anyway, this is the only way I'd get to explore, so...
Yeah, maybe Sir David Attenborough, before he retires, could fit you in.
One more challenge, Sir David!
Blue Planet 2, Kay learns to swim. Could be there.
Could be there. Everyone would tune in for that, surely.
I wonder how many stars... This is going to get.
Oh, I don't know.
I mean, this is kind of like it deserves so many stars. It's off the scale, isn't it?
I know.
Is a six
all
star.
The stars.
It's the golden stars. I think I said in my preview on Heat Magazine, if this is, you know, if you don't watch this, then what's the matter with
you're
you?
Stupid.
Even John, who's not watched any of these classic TV series, should be sitting down.
John, are you going to watch it?
Yeah, of course.
BBC One, next Sunday, 29th of October at 8 p.m. That's when you should be sitting in front of your television and watching it.
And it's 5 stars from all of us.
It's 5 stars from all of us. And it's going to look particularly good in HD on my 17-inch television.
God. You're such... No, poor John's got a cardboard box and you're going on about your HD.
Well, you know, I just wanted to mention. Okay. It is made for the HD.
Good for you, Boydo. I'm happy for you.
And the music is by Hans Zimmer, by the way.
The music is brilliant.
One of the great film composers of our time. Mm. Let's move on to, in sharp contrast, as we have to say, Living the Dream, which is on
which
Sky One.
Which we're very much doing right now, Boydo.
We are, always, every week. Sky One/Now TV, starting next Thursday, the 2nd of November, at 9 p.m. Shall I describe this?
Yes.
Considering you did a very good job of a bang-up job, Kay, of describing Blue Planet 2. This is a comedy drama from the makers of Cold Feet, and it stars Philip Glenister and Leslie Sharp, two of our finest actors working today, as a married couple, Mal and Jen, and they've got two kids, kind of teenagerish kids, and they decide to up roots from their rainy Yorkshire world to move to Florida and to manage a trailer park. So somehow he, Philip Glenister's character, has been told, yeah, you know, this is an easy thing. You send a brochure for a trailer park in Florida. It's all sunny and lovely, and there's the families hanging out, you know, having barbecues and swimming in the pool. And he just has to take over the management of it. It's all going to be great.
What could be simpler?
Well, it's not quite as he expected. The trailer park turns out to be this complete shithole, basically, and full of really terrifying redneck-type dudes. Kids aren't allowed. There's loads of handwritten signs.
It's an adults-only park.
Funny things. So it's an adults-only park. So they don't want all these, like, womanizing dudes, don't want any kids interfering. And there's loads of handwritten signs saying adults only, kids not allowed, which is quite funny. So it's all about how, you know, it's like fishes out of water, dealing with the cultural change moving from Britain to America, and particularly this world of Florida with lots of retired people and lots of very glamorous people, glamorous Americans. And I very much enjoyed it. I mean, I do really like, I'm a huge fan of Leslie Sharp. Let me say right now, she is, for me, one of the greats of acting of recent years. Everything
Boyd is using
does.
Two hands to gesticulate how great he thinks she is.
I am using two hands, yeah, sorry. So for me, it's like anything she does, I'm biased about and I'm immediately drawn to. And she's fantastic in this. And what particularly I liked about it was that the depiction of the married couple, so it sounds a bit cliched, everything about it sounds a bit stereotyped, and it definitely has stereotypes and cliches in it. But let me just quickly say this before you hold forth. I know you're champing at that bit. Let me just say what I really liked about it was I thought the depiction of the married couple was very believable and didn't sink into cliche. So you think, oh, he's the doofus who's got everything wrong and she's going to be berating him, but she kind of deals with him very well. It's all about how do you deal with a doofus of a husband, and she's like, he knows that she's much cleverer than he is and much more organised, and how does he deal with that? And I thought it was very well done, that whole dynamic.
What's really funny, right, I really enjoyed that bit as well,
right?
Because, you know, it could have just gone down the well-trodden route of he does this stupid thing, she goes mental, you know, the usual. But so I was really happy it didn't go down that road. But having said that, I just think there was one moment when he'd done something, like obviously he'd realised he'd bought this kind of, as Boyd said, shit of a park. And she was just kind of like, she was like, oh, well, you know, I love a project. And like, you know, just, I don't know. I think she would have gone a bit more batshit crazy than she did. Just a little bit. Because I don't think it would be just as easy. Like, I like the fact that she didn't go crazy.
Indeed.
And I didn't want her to do that.
No.
But I just think, you know, just kind of like patting him on the shoulder and saying, oh, I love you, and kissing him. I just don't know if a wife or a girlfriend, if someone had invested all their money in a trailer trash park, would be saying that.
Oh, no, I believed it because I just thought, you know, it's such a big thing, isn't it? You've moved your entire life and family to Florida, and you've got to make it work, really. I think that's the underlying thing.
Absolutely.
So I think her, it's like, I've got to be sensible.
Absolutely. I would obviously do that as well, but there'll be at least one day in that doghouse. Just one day sleepover in the doghouse.
No, I'm sticking with my point. I think it's believable. I think it doesn't always try to not slip in. I mean, it gets very quite slapsticky towards the end of the episode because there's like crocodiles roaming around. He has to wrestle, and everything goes horribly wrong. Everything sets fire to things, and it all builds to a suitably kind of ridiculous climax. But I thought I really liked it, and I thought the kids were good.
Kids were good. I actually really, when it first started, I was like, because there's a neighbor called, I think, is it Rhoda or something? She's like this kind of OTT American neighbor who I just didn't like, and I was like, oh god, it's just going to tick all the cliches, the whole thing's going to be like a bit of a nightmare. And Leslie Sharp really saved it for me, because I was like, no, she's really good. And then, consequently, I started to actually find myself laughing along and thinking, oh, you know what? It's quite fun, and it's like, it's enjoyable. It's not It's not going to get any best drama awards, but it's...
No, it's not going to change the world of television. But I think it's a good... I think it's like indicative a little bit of Sky, because it feels... They've had a few very pleasant... kind of comedy drama. Comedy drama is a hard thing to do. I think I said this about Cold Feet. I think I went on about this. Because it's got to be funny, and you've got to be interested in the characters, and there's got to be dramatic situations. And they've had a few attempts, I think, on Sky, which haven't been... They've been great. They've been nice and enjoyable. I think this is a bit of a step up in that genre. I'm not going to name names.
Oh, what?
Well, I can't remember the names, partly. Like, I'm talking about like 5 years ago. Okay. You know, the thing they were trying to do was like family-friendly comedy drama... Like Stella is a good one. Stella was the best one that's just finished. Stella, the last ever episode, Ruth Jones's series. That's a comedy drama completely in this mold. And I think this is potentially as good as that, whereas they had some that didn't work as well a few years ago. It's hard. Anyway, Living the Dream, how many stars are you giving it, Kay?
3.5 stars.
I'm giving it 4.4. Ooh. A solid 4. So that's Living the Dream. It's a 6-parter. It's on Sky One and Now TV next Thursday, the 2nd of November at 9 o'clock. And at this point, Kay, tragically,
no,
I'm afraid I'm going to have to eject you from the podcast booth.
Don't. Just because I don't want to watch Stranger Things.
You've never watched Stranger Things. You haven't watched Series 2 of Stranger Things. You just don't deserve a space in this bit of the podcast now. I'm being silly.
All right, fine. I'm going.
But you are leaving us, and it's a big, wholehearted welcome back to Steph Seelan.
I'm here.
How are you doing?
I'm very well. I'm glad Kay's not here because I can't talk to her at the moment.
No, she's not allowed to be here for the Stranger Things review.
Do you know anyone else who hasn't watched Stranger Things 1?
Well, John, our guru.
Well, you need to leave now. Yeah. Just show us which buttons to press on the equipment. No, seriously, get out.
But there's loads of things John hasn't seen, so yeah.
Okay.
It's fine. It's part of a whole lack of TV viewing.
The lack of commitment is outrageous.
We don't want to encourage.
No.
So, but you and I, so we should say this now, we are reviewing Stranger Things 2, 9 episodes. We've both watched all 9 episodes.
Yep.
It drops on Friday. Do you know, someone was telling me, who was it? You're not allowed to say drop anymore. The Netflix people don't encourage drop.
Why?
Yeah. I don't know.
What's the new word?
I don't know, arrive or something? Someone was telling me that. I think it might have been Charlie Brooker. I did a thing with him a couple of weeks ago. Name drop.
I see. Nicely done.
Yeah. So anyway, Stranger Things 2, all 9 episodes arrive on Friday in classic Netflix style. And we're going to try and do a non-spoiler review. Yeah. But I would warn people, if you've never seen it and you're going to watch Series 1 and then Series 2, I mean, we're going to be talking about... It's like, imagine it's like a 9-hour film or even a...
Yeah.
You do the math, 17-hour film, all season 1 and 2 together. We're kind of going to review it like that, aren't we? So we're going to talk about the premise and roughly what's going on at the beginning of season 2,
for example. But
We're not going to ruin it, and we're not going to give away any key elements. But we are going to talk about it in general, where the characters are. New characters, I think we can talk about that.
Yeah.
And what we think of it. So if you don't want to know anything, if you want to go in completely cold, as some people do, then... don't listen to the last 15 minutes.
I don't think anyone's going to go... Do you think anyone's going to go Stranger Things 2 without going Stranger Things 1, though?
Oh, no. That would be madness.
Okay, so let's just say, don't do it.
Don't
if you're
do
thinking
that,
about
no,
it, don't do that.
Cretinous.
It's ridiculous.
Yeah, it's a sequel. It's a proper sequel, isn't it? That's the first thing to say about, really, this series is I think some season 2s, like, they come back years later or...
They can be standalone. You can dip in, dip out.
Right. Whereas this is completely...
Committed.
A sequel proper, like a film sequel.
Things you will not understand if you haven't watched Series 1.
No.
So don't be stupid, people.
Don't be
foolish.
Don't be silly. Watch Season 1 if you haven't watched Season 2. Yeah. If you haven't watched Season 1, then you will know roughly what we're talking about in Season 2. So I guess it starts out, Season 1 was all about... the disappearance of this young guy and a teenager.
Will,
thank you.
He's not a teenager.
He's 13, isn't he now? Isn't he 13 now?
Now he is.
Well, what's the official...
They're at middle school, aren't they? What is middle school, actually? Hawkins Middle School is the school they're at.
Yeah, that's their age this year. But what's officially a teenager now? Is it 14, do you think?
Yeah,
it's 13, 14. It's the cusp.
Okay, fine.
All right. Yeah, but he's a high schooler.
Okay.
Fair enough, yeah. I've already got something wrong. Called him a teenager. Yeah. He's not even a bloody teenager. Will, played by Noah Schnapp, he disappeared.
Yeah.
And effectively, if you have season... This is not spoiling it, so we're assuming you've seen season 1.
Yeah.
He ended up in this place called the Upside Down, which is like a parallel dimension, isn't it? I guess is the kind
of... Yeah, it's a parallel dimension, which is just dark and twisted and just full of kind of... darkness and nothingness,
and actual monsters.
Yeah, and there are monsters. Yeah. There are monsters.
There's this thing called the Demogorgon, which was the kind of main monster. This kind of like a disgusting, slimy thing with a really hideous, big, screamy, mouthy thing with loads of like teeth.
It looks a bit like a flower if a flower opens, but if a flower was really mean and was going to eat you.
Yeah, that's true. So there's this horrible creature there, very dark. Disturbing things happen. And then there was 11 arrived, this young girl,
But crucially, yes, like everyone needs a gang of people right to look out for them. So Will's got this little gang of friends yeah that go to a middle school. They're all buddies and they're all very concerned about him going missing. And he's also got a very concerned mother, played by Winona Ryder, and a very concerned older brother, yes, Jonathan,
yes,
who's wonderful.
Yes, and they spent most of the first season trying to find him, yes, those people, yeah, his peers, his peer group, the gang of three.
Yeah.
But then 11 arrived, this mysterious young girl, played by Millie Bobby Brown, who's like the breakout yeah star, I guess, wasn't she? And she had strange powers, and every time she had kind of like powers of a bit like in Carrie, you know, when Carrie can physically move things and stop things.
When she gets angry, the powers are even more yeah intense.
It's very Carrie-esque, I felt, yeah, all along. Even more so, you might say, in the season two. And her nosebleed.
She gets a little nosebleed afterwards.
And she was also, we learned through flashbacks mainly, was kind of grew up, essentially, in this...
In a lab.
In a lab, in the Hawkins Laboratory, being run by weird, spooky spooks, kind of mysterious agents who are
Matthew Modine, who played her papa, who basically, they had this horrible relationship where obviously she kind of had a father-daughter relationship with him, where actually he was testing her and submerging her in water and trying to get to the upside down.
Yeah.
But it was just, he was a bad guy.
Yeah. And I guess she was generally considered dangerous because she has these powers. And it's yeah like, well, you know, if they're human beings, a bit like kind
she's
of X-Men
a weapon
style. She's a weapon, yeah. She's kind of like a, you know, has these very dangerous powers that other governments might be interested in. That was the kind of implication, wasn't it?
Yeah.
You know, maybe if the Russians in the 80s. Yeah. This is all set in the 80s, of course, the other big thing about it. So it's got this huge, big, kind of nostalgic quality yeah to it. Oh, not only when we got Winona Ryder as the mother figure, but you also had loads of 80s songs on the soundtrack, yeah, a very 80s synth style to the original music. And the whole thing felt like a kind of, to me, one of the things I loved about it is it felt like a kind of
homage
summary,
to, yeah,
homage to Steven Spielberg, Close Encounters, E.T.
It's got everything
Stand
in it.
Stand By Me, yeah, Stephen King, all those things kind of melded together into one
if
joyous
you
whole.
If you are a child of the 80s, I mean, it is literally perfect yeah for you, isn't it? You're just yeah going to be, it's horribly frightening and also heartwarming at the same time.
Yeah.
But crucially, the difference with this series is that in the last series where Will went missing, and you really don't see a lot of Will no at all because he was missing for the whole of the first series, and the other person that goes missing in the Upside Down is Barb.
Yes, famously.
Famously, Barb goes missing, okay? And that was a big thing that everybody really, really took hold of that, didn't they?
Yeah.
Justice for Barb. But in this series, Will features heavily.
Yeah,
he is
back.
The main guy.
Yeah. So the whole. Where are they now? So it's 1984 now, and you're reminded of that with there's election going on.
Yeah. Reagan Bush.
Mondale. Walter Mondale was the terrible Democratic candidate, and he's back in the bosom of the community of Hawkins yeah community, but he's still disturbed, isn't he? He's having visions.
Well, if you remember at the end of the final scene of last season, he is in the bathroom and he coughs yes and splutters, and then some black nastiness creeps
yeah
out of his mouth.
Right, exactly. So. Yeah. So there's something's happened to him when he was in the Upside Down. He's been infected somehow, and a large part of this series is kind of what does that mean? What are the visions he's having? What effect has the whole experience of being in the Upside Down for so long had on him? And that's a huge part of it. And he as you say, he's kind of hugely featured. It's all about what is happening to him and is it what's the effect of that going to be on the rest of the town, his friends, all of that. Yeah. Similarly, now here's, I'm going to tread lightly about
okay,
11.
Okay, tread very
because,
lightly.
But luckily, because one of the big things was she went off to rescue him, but as a result ended up in the Upside Down.
Broken into a thousand pieces.
And presumably, you know, we presume know what's happened to her. She could have died. She could
yep
have disappeared forever, trapped in the Upside Down forever. They completely deal with what happens
yep
to her. And she is in, I think we can safely say this. Without,
we can
say
she's
in
this
series
in it
throughout.
She is.
But what happens to her is fascinating.
It's another sub-story, isn't it?
It's a whole sub-story. Mm. She's what her situation is.
Yep.
And I definitely think we shouldn't reveal that.
But, no, absolutely not.
But she's completely, I think for me, having watched all 9 episodes
yep
and thinking about the power of it. It's definitely for me like the two key things are her,
yeah,
11,
yeah,
and him, Will, and what's happening to both of them simultaneously.
Yeah.
They're kind of different but connected, and you see her interrelationships, her kind of, you know, a relationship with various adults and a relationship with the boys.
Because also you have to remember that he had a relationship with the boys, his gang of
yeah
boys, and she had a relationship,
yeah,
but never the two shall meet, because she didn't actually meet Will.
Exactly.
And she and she may or may not meet Will in this season.
Right, exactly.
We cannot confirm or deny.
No. Meanwhile, I wanted to mention that Winona Ryder, that Will's mum, Joyce, who spent the entire first season in a state of high distress.
Yes.
Literally, pretty much every scene that she had to do, that Winona Ryder was either crying or screaming or just in a state of... Because a young boy disappeared.
Yeah.
And she didn't know what... And she was trying to get messages from him from the other dimension. In this, she's much happier. She's back, thank God. And she's having a relationship.
She's able... She has... there are a few scenes where she is actually happy, but there is also a lot of distress for her in this.
Sure.
But initially, most importantly, are we going to say who the person who's making her happy? The person who's making her happy is Sean Astin, who plays Bob.
Yes.
Now, again, if you're a child of the 80s, Goonies, hello, this is amazing. Mm. And also, let's just talk about the other role. Now, Will is being treated in a lab with his post-traumatic stress disorder by the great Paul Reiser.
Yeah, Dr. Owens, who's the doctor. And he's like the new, the guy, instead of Papa, the disturbing figure of series one, who was the main guy running the lab, who was really awful. This guy, we're not quite sure. He seems nicer.
You don't know.
But we don't know. That's one of the big mysteries of the series, which we should just park there. But he's key. But the big new stars, Sean Astin and Paul Reiser, both really 80s, iconic 80s figures, aren't they?
That just add to that warm feeling of but when you watch this, you just think, oh God, I'm home. Yeah. I'm just home.
And then finally, just setting up what we're going to explain about what's happening, is these new characters, the main two young characters, who I think are absolutely phenomenal again, are Billy and Max. Now, Billy is this really nasty teen...
He's a nasty bastard.
Jock. He's your classic... But it's almost like he's there and he's like showing that actually, like Steve, who was in that love triangle, wasn't he, with Jonathan and Nancy.
Mm.
Jonathan, the brother.
Of Will, older brother of Will.
And Jonathan, there was this always kind of unspoken attraction going on.
Yeah.
But she was actually going out with Steve, and he was the big hunky.
He's the jock.
Big hair jock. But now he's been completely blown out of the water jock-wise by this new character.
And hair-wise, maybe.
And hair-wise, And this dude is extraordinary, isn't he? Billy, played by Dacre Montgomery.
Oh, the mullet on it is just incredible, unbelievable.
Mullet, blonde mullet. And he also struts around most of the series with his shirt open to the waist, showing his pecs. I mean, he's pretty much...
I know, but he's gorgeous. Yeah. I mean, love. I mean, the mullet aside, he's got a lovely face
on him.
But not
a nice guy.
Horrendous guy.
Figure. And his stepsister is a key new character, Max, played by Sadie Sink, and she wants to join the gang. The gang feel like she's a skateboarder, she's a cool, and she's a bit of an outsider like they are. And she's kind of like half in, half out of the gang, isn't she?
Yeah.
She's a fascinating figure, I think.
Yeah, she's brilliant. Brilliant addition.
So what is it?
Let's not spoil it. For me, I was just so happy to see every single one of them. I thought it was absolutely brilliant. I think the Duffer brothers have done an amazing job at continuing a story, but making it completely fascinating. Like, I watched the whole 9 episodes, as you know, because I text you. I watched basically 6 on Saturday and then 3 on Sunday morning. And I just... I loved it. I think it's perfect. I felt like there was more music in it this time, which I really, really liked. But I have to say, what I really loved is the little subplots throughout and the little relationships between different characters really made it perfect for me. I love Dustin, who's, if you remember, he's the curly-haired guy who wears the cap. He's kind of the really cute
one. Yeah, Gaten Matarazzo, so,
He, like... The little chats that he has with his mum, the little intermingling between characters that didn't necessarily talk to each other so much in the first series, it just is perfect.
And he has he has a little creature, he discovers a little creature in his bin. I think we can say that.
Okay, he discovers a little creature in his bin, and that... Yeah.
What is that little creature? Is a key.
And it's very cute.
It's very cute. I agree. I think, because the first series... I mean, I'm trying to list all the things that were incredible about the first series for me. I wrote a review of it in Heat Magazine, which comes out today, this season 2, and I began it by saying that the first series for me felt like it had been made especially for me, because I grew up, I am of an age where I grew up watching these things in the 80s. You know, I was watching Close Encounters of the Third Kind and E.T., and all those things, all those Steven Spielberg things.
Bless you.
Thanks. The first series is basically like an 8-hour homage to Steven Spielberg with quite a lot of Steven King
training. And why not?
So... you know, I was I couldn't believe it when this whole thing became a massive pop culture phenomenon that it became, and that everyone else loved it as well. But that's because it was also incredibly funny. Like the relationships between the kids were brilliantly observed and very funny and real.
Yeah,
you saw these. They swear and they talk about stuff they're not supposed to talk about.
That's the brilliant thing. Like, it's so weird. When I was watching it, I was thinking, they're so bloody clever, Netflix, because what they've done is they've brought this out, and who does it appeal to? It appeals to this, all of these people who love to binge box sets. And what age were those people in the 80s? Those are all these things that these people love. They're all the people now that are binging stuff on Netflix, and it's perfect.
Yeah, but I think also, but what I was going to say beyond that is that I think it appeals to a huge array of people, because I think teenagers are going to identify with the teenagers. I am calling them teenagers in the show, because they're so brilliantly depicted.
The preteens.
Whatever they are. Because they swear and they fall in love. And you know, all of that is dealt with in a brilliantly believable, realistic way, the way they speak. And they're so smart. And it's a celebration of the outsider, particularly. This is the thing. Yeah. There's a brilliant line, I think it's in episode one, where Charlie Heaton talks to his brother who's come back from
the hospital. Oh, yeah, he's in episode one.
And he says, and his brother's been called a freak by all the schoolmates. And he says, yeah, you are a freak. You should be proud of being a freak. David Bowie's a freak.
Yeah.
And that was like a brilliant little.
Yeah, who would you rather be, David Bowie or Kenny Rogers?
Or Kenny Rogers, exactly. Everyone wants to be David Bowie.
Yeah.
So it's a celebration of the outsider and of freaks. In life, which I think is brilliant, and that's they're all the way through, kind of as a big theme of it. And also, it is, as I was saying, funny that those characters are brilliantly funny. It can go from the funniness, and it is genuinely scary. Like when it wants to be scary, it really ramps it up.
It really is frightening.
So it really is frightening. There wasn't that much that was frightening. I think for me, in about the first half of almost of the series.
No, but in the second half, there are certainly bits where you go, oh God, no, please, no, oh no.
Steph did just scream.
But you'll do it as well, so you'll understand.
Steph screamed at the top of her voice, but I'm sure.
But isn't that what you were doing, Boyd?
John will be able to turn it down a little bit, so it's not deafening people.
I'm just warning you.
Yeah, but it's properly scary, it's funny, and it's incredibly lovable. There's it's very emotionally engaging, because you really care about the relationships. You really care about Eleven, and is she going to? Can she live a normal life?
Yeah.
Can she, you know, with how are people going to deal with her? You really care about. I mean, I think Will. You know, because we didn't see much of him, as you say. The performance.
I know.
His performance is the stuff he has to go through.
Oh my God. Do you know what? I had assumed, and now this is probably incredibly foolish, I thought they've got him to play Will in the first season.
Yeah.
Because he doesn't do that much acting in it.
Yeah.
And actually, maybe he's the weak link out of that group of boys. And I had assumed that because he's very cute looking, but I thought, he hasn't really acted very much in this. He owns this season, and he is a brilliant little actor. And actually, the guy who plays little Mike, who was obviously he dominated the first season because he was the one looking after Eleven.
Finn Wolfhard.
Oh, equally brilliant. Yeah. But I was really, really pleasantly surprised at how amazing he was.
Noah
great.
Schnapp. So he is phenomenal. And he's genuine. That's the other thing we should say is that, you know, the people that are playing this age are that age. So he's 13 years old. Noah Schnapp, who, without wanting to give anything away, has to go through extraordinary things in this
great
series.
Physical acting
everything,
as well.
Everything,
yeah.
Everything. Is unbelievably brilliant. 13. I genuinely am awestruck as to how the directors, it's got, apart from the Duffer Brothers,
there's
lots of different
directors. Because they've got different directors,
Lots of different directors and writers throughout the series. Nine episodes, there's a lot to deal with.
Yeah.
And it's each a lot episode. It is a 9-hour film. And how brilliant he is. And a 13-year-old. Just has to cope with everything. And equally, Millie Bobby Brown, even more than series one, has to go through all of these extremes of emotions they put through. And she's, again, phenomenal. I think she's only 13 still.
Yeah, it's ridiculous, isn't it?
I think...
Crazy talent.
I genuinely think this time next year, or next year when they do the Emmys, they're going to have to nominate these people, and they're going to have to win proper acting performances, because they're not just
an ensemble cast.
They're holding themselves up in the company of Winona Ryder. So, but anyway, bottom line is... Is it as good as season one? Because season one, let's face it, is the pop cultural phenomenon of all of Netflix. It's, you know, even beyond what the other thing, you know, House of Cards and Orange is the New Black.
Yeah.
This is the show that's hit home, punched through, everyone's obsessed with it. Is it as good as season one?
I think yes. My reasoning for this is because actually you left that series wanting to know more about those characters, and particularly Hopper, who was the police chief, you really get to know him more, and actually you really get to know more of everyone's emotions, and why wouldn't you? And I just, they standard is still brilliant. I thought the special effects were amazing actually in this season.
Yeah.
And they've managed to keep that magic that I just think it's, I think if you loved Strange Things 1, I cannot see you having a problem with this in any way whatsoever. I know you had a slight issue with one of the episodes, well, didn't you, boys?
Yeah, but I had a slight issue with one or two of the episodes in season one. There's one episode, again, without giving anything away, that takes you out of the general. So all the way through nine episodes, pretty much, it's cross-cutting between all the different characters and the different subplots. There's one episode, without, I don't want to give anything away.
It takes you out of Hawkins.
Seven takes you, exactly, yeah. Takes you out of the small town and into something else. And it follows one character's journey, if you like, and focuses completely on that character. And I felt I didn't quite like that whole world. It just took me out of it a bit. So it's a minor gripe. Yeah. It's a small gripe. And in fact, right at the beginning of this series, it shows you this other world is to set it up.
Yeah, it does.
But apart from that, I think it is better. I think it's...
I think it's better?
Yeah, because I think it goes deeper.
It does go deeper.
And I think now... And it's one of those things where now we know the characters so well. It's making them more believable. You know, you kind of feel you really know them, like particularly the kids. You know, I was just amazed by how brilliantly drawn, particularly like Max, the new kid. She's so good, that character, and for the writers and directors to kind of almost effortlessly introduce another new teenage character, and it's important because she is a girl, and obviously the gang of three or four kids, boys, was kind of like, even with 11, it felt a bit like a celebration of boys, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I think it's very clever they've brought in this girl, and how they react to her and how she deals with them is brilliantly realistic. So apart from anything else, it's about like teenage interrelationships and growing up and how you deal
with
all
that. It's got like Ferris Bueller, so Pretty in Pink, it's got everything in it.
So for me, it deepened the themes and it deepened the characters, and I think it's even better than Series 1.
Did you find yourself though watching these, because I did, being a child of the 80s, thinking, oh god, I hope when all these lot grow up they don't get, you know, they all have good careers, because like I don't know, I was just like picturing their future.
Well, already Finn Wolfhard was in it and was brilliant in it.
Oh, was he? Yeah. Oh, I haven't
I think
seen
Millie
that
Robbie Brown's going to be in the next King Kong film, so I think they're already, I think they will.
I hope they get looked after.
Yeah, but I sat there thinking they've got to do season three. I think they are. I think they're shooting season
and
three,
and we should say there is a possibility to do season three way that this ends.
I think season three is
okay, is that all right? That's not a spoiler,
I think that's
fine.
Confirmed, yeah. Oh, yeah, they don't all die, as I say every week about the
There spoilers. Is some death, though.
Yeah, but they don't all die.
Yeah,
And what I'm saying is that, for me, I think they have to shoot season three really quickly because you don't want those kids to grow up too quickly. Do you want them to stay in this
because
level?
Because there is a few scenes where Millie Bobby Brown is walking and she's just as tall as some other people, and you're a bit like, oh, no, this has all gone a bit wrong. Yeah.
And I'm sure they're aware of it. I'm sure they'll be shooting season three any day now. How many stars are we going to give Stranger Things?
If we give
two?
Anything less than five, we'd be idiots.
I was so pleased how brilliant
it
was.
Yeah, me too.
It's five.
We're pleased. We're pleased. Well done, the Duffer Brothers.
Thrilled.
We're very happy.
It's a triumph all round.
Yeah.
Nine episodes, Friday.
Try and just watch one if you can, but you will not. You'll have to watch all nine.
It's the greatest treat you could possibly wish for this Halloween, isn't it?
It absolutely. Yeah. Do you know what that is? Absolutely what it is.
It's a binge. And you know what? Because it is a classic binge.
Oh, it is a classic
binge.
And because
you've been off, away from the bloody podcast, doing your own thing.
I know. Unbelievable.
Whatever it is. You've been binging on stuff. So we thought, it's time for question time.
So, right.
What is your favourite? The question is.
Oh, go on.
What is your favourite binge?
Right. Now, you know when you think you can watch too much television? I can tell you, you can't. Okay,
because you can't. No, of course not.
I decided, so I've had 2 weeks away, and I decided that I would use that time to watch some TV. And I decided to watch Breaking Bad from the first series.
Well, that's of course one of the shows that John hasn't seen. It was revealed early on in the podcast.
John, I was a you.
Yeah.
I was a you, and now I'm better than you because I've watched Breaking Bad. Now, 5 seasons of Breaking Bad, okay.
Is that 10 episodes a season?
No. There's 14.
Oh, okay. God.
Okay. I don't even want to calculate how many hours that is, but it's a lot of hours. Now, I have to say, at various points, I nearly gave up because it's a bit relentless when you keep, like, I just thought, oh, I can't take any more of him turning into Heisenberg. But what I did is I fell into a big hole of Wikipediaing everything that those two have ever said to about each other, Aaron Paul and what's his face? Well, I can't remember his name. Bryan Cranston. And now I'm deeply in love with their relationship. But Aaron Paul, now I understand what all the fuss is about because he is obviously incredible.
Yeah.
So that was a huge binge.
Wait a minute. Let's just clarify this. You watched the entire Breaking Bad, 60-something episodes in a week, effectively.
In 2 weeks. Because, hold on, I had other things to watch.
Yeah,
so I also binged the whole of Mindhunter, which is Netflix, available on Netflix now. Yeah. excellent. FBI, the start of the whole FBI profiling.
Yeah.
Have you finished that?
Yeah, we dealt with that at the beginning of the podcast.
I've done it as well. And I finished Insecure, season two. Yeah. I was not happy with the ending of that.
Okay, but these are your great. I'm going to pin you down to your best one, your favorite. This is question time. This isn't you know, you just holding.
Me just telling you what I've been doing.
Yeah. I'm fascinated, but you got to pin it down.
I've been off for a week, so I've forgotten. Right, my greatest box set binge ever. Oh, Damages, first season, Glenn Close, 100%. Have you watched Damages?
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, I think I gave up after. It was about three or four seasons, weren't
there? There were four seasons of Damages. Yeah. It's amazing. Oh, I think that's not been five, actually. You have, really?
No.
Oh, God, why?
I don't know. Anyway, I'll remedy that, yes.
I feel like not even asking you, but I will. What's yours?
Well, I was thinking about this quite seriously. I was thinking, what does it mean, you know, what's your favourite? And I was thinking about the experience of binge-watching stuff. You know, it's become a cliche, hasn't it? But I was thinking of what is the actual thing that has been on that have been all available in one go in that style, as Netflix have kind of made their own, even though, of course, people have been doing it for years, actually. And I've narrowed it down to the night of. The actual experience.
That as a binge.
Yeah, so Sky, because Sky / Now TV, they waited. When the night of was an HBO show, the Riz Ahmed show about what, you know, him, had he killed this woman that he ended up next to, slaughtered in bed after one night bumping into her. And it was an incredible, brilliant American crime story / just look into prejudice and all of that. And I think it was eight hours. And Sky brilliantly waited until all the episodes had gone out in America so they could present it in one go if you wanted to watch it in one go. And I did watch it in one go.
Yeah.
And it was incredibly riveting. And
that's
the one that sticks out as the actual experience of me going, oh, right, I'm going to watch all of this in one go, pretty much. An 8-hour thing, and it did not let me down, and I thought it was unbelievably brilliant and my favourite thing of that year. So it's the night of.
Do you know what, though? It's so funny you say about the whole binging thing, because I was thinking about this yesterday once I'd finished Stranger Things 2, and I really wanted to like tweet and say, oh yeah, I've just finished Stranger Things 2, but really what that's saying is I have got nothing else better to do, and actually I should just get outside.
Steph, there's no never be, ever be guilty or ashamed.
I did.
Never
I feel got
ashamed
a bit. But you know what?
Binge.
Also, I have literally probably watched, I mean, I want to say 700 hours of television over the last 2 weeks.
I'm impressed by the Breaking Bad or the entirety of Breaking Bad.
I also watched Law and Order, True Jesus Crime, Christ. The Menendez Brothers. It's great. That is also on Sky at the moment. You should catch that.
How many episodes is that?
Well, there's one left. Actually, I've done four, so it's the final one. Yeah, but it's got what's her name from Sopranos? What's that actress? Blonde actress.
I don't know. You are just listing
who plays his wife. Sorry, I know. This is like Steph's question time.
Yeah.
Kay's poor John. Good job, Kay's not here. She'll be furious.
Right. Anyway, yes, but the bottom line is The bottom line is Stranger Things is one of the greatest.
Stranger Things is amazing. The Night Of is amazing. Damages first season is amazing. As are all the other things that we've mentioned.
Thank you. There we go. And we'll be back next week to talk about more incredible popular culture and television.
It's
goodbye from me.
It's a goodbye from me.
Thanks.